and welcome to the Crate and Crowbar. It's the 19th of May?
April.
Hello. And this is episode number 137. Yeah! I'm Philippa War. And with me today are Chris Thurston.
Hi.
And Tom Francis.
Hello.
We're in April. Good.
It's
excellent.
April. What other news?
Well,
it's April.
We just watched a trailer for a Supergiant game reveal.
Pyre. Supergiant, if you're not aware, are the creators of Bastion and Transistor.
I wasn't aware because I've played neither of those.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I was aware, but...
What did you make of this one?
It looked a lot like the stylized enemies from one of the more recent Zelda games.
Mm.
What's the one that I have on the DS?
Legend of Zelda.
The Revenge of Zelda.
Winds of Time.
The one that's on the 3DS. It reminded me of those enemies and that kind of basic art
style. The big clock.
Sounds of the xylophone.
The 2D
Paper Mario.
Yes, fine.
Wind Waker?
No.
Although it reminded me of Wind Waker a lot more, actually. So
I don't know any of the Zeldas.
So it's called Pyre.
Yes.
It's about exiles doing some kind of competition in the wilderness to be let back into society.
I think it's the underworld.
Oh.
It's called the Downside. Oh. And I can't remember if I inferred this or if it actually said it, but it sounded like they've been banished to the underworld and they got to earn their place back in wherever it is that they were banished from.
Maybe it's purgatory.
Yeah. That's kind of the impression I got. And you play a team of things, whereas previously it's always been based around like one character.
Is it a co-op RPG? Is it like meaningfully multiplayer?
I haven't seen any mention of that. But I think it's more like a sort of tactical thing where you're controlling multiple people in battle, so you sort of switch between them. You're in competition with other exiles, and only the winners will be return in triumph, I think is the way they phrase it, and everyone else will die.
So these other competitors aren't like your friends list or anything?
I don't think so. Okay. But it's...
Because that would be dark.
It has an overworld, weirdly. The trailer's a really, like, confusing mishmash. I didn't really understand it at all from looking at it. Most of this comes from the post on the PlayStation blog. But there's bits of, like, a cart bouncing around a kind of, side-on landscape. Mm. And it's very kind of... The style of that feels weird because it's very, like, sort of jaunty and kind of playful.
Old school, like Disney. Yeah. Yeah.
And then the style of the other stuff seems more like Bastion. Who are those big, like, blue guys in Bastion that are kind of like a basic enemy quite early on?
Gas fellas. Gas boy.
Gas fellas is also funny, but is true. Your people remind me a bit of that with masks.
It's definitely an evolution of the same genre of sort of abstract, isometric action RPG thing. In this case, you play three blue wizards in masks that might be from a Zelda game, and one of them's a dog.
When you see them with the masks on, it looks weird because you expect the main character to have a face or something, but then there's other scenes where, like, there's dialogue and they have portraits, and I think I've sort of seen where their masks are, like, hanging up, so those are just things they wear for combat, I guess.
Yeah. Mm. The exile trial masks, I guess.
Something about it, like... I mean, I don't really understand what it is yet, so it's too soon to judge. But the idea of like a competition type thing doesn't excite me as much as, Transistor, which was waking up alone in this weird digital city and trying to survive.
It's interesting because Bastion didn't really have, I don't think it had like a reveal trailer in the same way as, because they didn't know what those games were going to be. And there wasn't like a super giant community of fans who like that particular mix of stuff that they do. But I remember I was very excited by the Transistor reveal trailer because it immediately painted this really evocative picture. Transistor, you play a woman singer, noir singer kind of deal in a noir city that's actually a computer. And she might be a computer, I guess. And then she has a sword, but the sword's also a computer. But the sword can talk.
Everything's a computer and a person.
Everything's a computer and a person and a sword. So, and then, you know, there's a great bluesy song over that first trailer, which I think was them sort of acknowledging that that's what they're, that's, they are the game developer who does that. They are the haunting blues melody over isometric cartoon abstract action thing.
At last.
Studio. Because Bastion had had a song in it that was enormously successful outside the game. People loved that soundtrack. And so did you play Bastion, Tom?
I did. I didn't like it as much as Transistor. Transistor was the one that really clicked with me. Mm. And I think maybe after Transistor, I went back to Bastion and liked it more. But I think I like the thing that clicked with me, a Transistor, that didn't click about Bastion. Maybe you might not click with this. Well, I don't know. But because Bastion made itself up as you went along, like literally the platforms appeared in front of you as you walked towards them and stuff. It was a really cool effect, but I never bought into it as a world. It never felt like a real place to me, whereas Transistor is very kind of coherent, even though it's completely mysterious as to what it actually is.
Yeah.
I might go back and try Transistor then, because I came to Bastion quite late, sort of having only really been familiar with it from shared announcer packs in Dota. And then I tried it and just really just couldn't get on with it and didn't really see why everybody else was losing their marbles over it and kind of going, oh, it was so great or so evocative or so, you know, this, that and the other.
Those
and
jerks.
I just didn't get it.
It's got a great combat system, like a legitimately great combat system when you get dig into it. Mm. It's got a couple of really good set pieces. It's got an amazing soundtrack. And then it's got a couple of really good set pieces. So there's just a... It's, you know, probably the game's closest to having like a full-on level that is a musical number in it, where you're kind of spiraling through this level towards the center, and at the center is a singer, and the song kind of develops as you make progress through the level and stuff. So it's really nice stuff. But it felt like they'd laid out their template in Bastion for kind of the stuff that they would be known for. So songs, for example. Mm. I think we all came away from the trailer for Pyre not necessarily digging the full-on power ballad being sung over the top of the trailer. It certainly doesn't set the mood for the game in the same way that the music over the Transistor trailer did.
I don't know. I have a fondness for a good power ballad. You know how I feel about the League of Legends world anthems at various points.
But is that not a little bit ironic?
Is that the one about, like, we'll meet again in cyberspace?
Oh, no, that was the world cyber games. My favourite is Warriors, which is the Imagine Dragons one from a couple of years ago, which I unironically embed it at the end of every League of Legends post where it seems even vaguely relevant.
It's the one with the cartoon music video where a bunch of guys, like teenagers playing League of Legends in their bedrooms, literally turn into beams of light, shoot into the sky,
like,
and become a new generation
of
superheroes.
The guy in the hoodie who smashes the keyboard kind of, you know, and is playing and everything, he puts his hood up and it's kind of a reference to the summoners, like the hooded figures of League of Legends lore. Well, yeah, and because you are a summoner when you play the game, although I think they've retconned a whole bunch of that, but you're still called summoners because
it is basically just esports prog. Nonetheless, Pyre has maybe wandered closer into esports prog territory than it's crazy to expect.
I don't know. It was one of those things where I felt I walked away from the trailer knowing the aesthetic, but not the game.
Mm. There's definitely like a shot in there, which is like cartoon characters fighting on an isometric map.
Yeah.
With stuff happening.
Yeah.
But I suppose, I mean, if someone had tried to explain the Transistor combat system to me before I played it, it would have made no sense whatsoever. So.
Yeah. Apparently there's an overworld and you get to make expressive decisions on the overworld. So,
what does that mean?
Don't know.
You've now made me
I'm going to expressively go left.
Yeah, exactly.
Not necessarily interested in playing the game, but interested in reading the PlayStation blog.
Yeah, we could load it up and just read it out. It's exciting that they're making... I mean, it's not necessarily a surprise that they're making something new, given that they've never made an unsuccessful game. But
What they do is... they make a game that's well received and then they make it for every fucking platform in the universe. Like, after they made the game, there's another sort of 2 years of just porting it to every single thing there is.
Coming soon to Engage.
That's how they make their money, basically. Mm.
They are a talented bunch of people.
Yeah.
Great art. Top art. I really like the pictures. That's what I'm saying. What have you been playing, Pip?
Well, I have only just this moment been playing Stephen's Sausage Roll, which I can talk about. Or, if you want a blast from the last year past, we can talk about Cradle.
We can talk about both, but Stephen's Sausage Roll seems like the game everyone is either very excited about or very angry about.
It's what I've been playing as well.
Yeah.
Are you excited or angry?
Neither.
So, yeah, just to describe quickly what it is, it's a tile-based puzzle game where your objective is to cook sausages by passing them over grill tiles. And the only catch is that you can't... Well, there's two catches. You can't push the sausage off the world that you've designated.
Do not push
and
the sausage.
As much as you'd like to. Sausages must not get in the sea.
And the other one is if you touch the side of the sausage against the grill tile more than once, then it gets burned and the entire thing is ruined.
There's also a lot of... So I'd heard about this game for years. It's kind of a legendary thing amongst puzzle designers because, you know, about 8 of them have had access to this thing for a very long time and have been raving about it. And apparently, I think Terry Kavanagh said that, like, Stephen was working on this back when those two were, like, living together, which must have been, I don't know, I think that was about 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah, I think so.
And it's been, like, someone else described it as his magnum opus. And, like... Jonathan Blow has said on many occasions it's one of the greatest puzzle games ever made, but no one can play it. And it, like, I actually started recently to entertain the idea that it might be fictional. Yeah. It might just be like a brilliant in-joke between puzzle designers. It's just, they all talk about this game about rolling sausages around that's fucking sublime and transcendent. And, but then I talked to Anna Hazelden about it, and he, you know, gushed enthusiastically and specifically about why it was so good. And he said of it exactly what I think about his games, which is that every level seems completely impossible until you realize some completely new thing that you didn't know before. And so that was kind of terrifying because I find that about his games. And if he's finding that about someone else's game, it means it's like next level impossible.
I was going to say, because it really feels Alan Hazelden-y from the couple of seconds I saw of it.
I think this and a lot of... like Michael Bro's games and a few other puzzle designers all take Sokoban as their kind of source reference point, which is the sort of platonic form of pushing crates around.
Alan actually made a game called Sokoban, of the like chemical elements that you push together
with
to form
Harry
molecules.
Lee, I think.
Yeah.
And so it's still pushing these around, but now the things are 2 squares long instead of 1 square long, and they roll as you push them. And the other complication is that you have a fork that's phenomenally awkward.
From your tummy.
It's incredibly, like, my first experience playing the game was very annoying. Because you just can't, like, your fork takes up a whole other tile. So you are basically 2 tiles long as well. And you can't turn round if there's a wall in the way. You can't walk forwards into the next step if there's a wall, you know, 2 spaces in front of you. As you turn around, your fork keeps hitting the sausages and knocking them off or pushing them onto grills when you don't mean to. And because it's vitally important which direction you're facing, it means you have to have turn controls as well as move controls. So it still only uses the cursor keys, but depending on the context, they will either turn or move you. So if you're facing up and you press left, you'll turn left but not move left. But if you pressed up, you'd move up. And if you press down, you would move down instead of turning.
But you
because you
backwards.
Can move backwards, because you have to be able to for certain moves. And so it's actually like, I thought at first that it was the mechanic itself that I was finding annoying, but actually I think it's just the controls. It's just because these, for me, turning should be character relative. If I press left, my character should turn to my character's left. Mm. But instead, left, if you're looking up or down, will turn left. But if you're looking left or right, it will move left. So that's just, I can never get my head around it. I make a mistake almost, you know, every other move is wrong.
Now you've said that, I think that's what I'm doing, because I think without realizing it consciously, I'm still expecting up to just be forwards relationally to the to the character.
Yeah, exactly.
And then for left and right to be clockwise and anti-clockwise.
Yeah. I think that would work perfectly. That lets you do everything, I think.
But yeah, and so it took me a while to get into that sort of the place where that was not causing extra problems, I think. And then after that, if I go away from it for a little while, then yeah. I have to find my way back into the control system again. But the puzzles themselves, so essentially you can kind of, in a witnessy way, go to any bit of it that is unlocked as long as you can figure out how to waddle your way across to certain things, I think.
There's like a holographic Stephen holding a fork in a certain direction, and it won't open the level unless you're standing in that hologram pointing your fork in the same direction.
Yeah, so you waddle over to... you waddle and you back yourself and you twist and turn over to one of these ghostly Stephens with a fork, and then you try and align yourself with it, which in itself can be a bit of a puzzle. And then... whole sections drop away and leave you with the relevant grill pans, and it kind of ignites those and then just shows you the sausages that you're trying to deal with.
Yeah, it's like I didn't actually understand the connection between the levels and the overworld until someone else described it, which is that like all the levels are out there in the overworld, so it's not like there's one tile you go and then it like zooms in or anything. The whole level is there, but the sausages are replaced with giant like cuboids of sausage meat that completely block your movement. So it actually, like, some of the levels do unlock other levels because you can't get past the sausage meat until you go into the level and solve it.
I think because I'm still so early on that I'm just sort of pottering between the first puzzles that I've encountered in the hopes of some kind of difficulty curve. But
yeah, as you say, the rest of the world falls away, and that's obviously like restricts the puzzle space. And that often, like, the whole challenge is just that you have no other space to work with and you've only got like these few tiles.
Yeah.
It's really, apparently there's other mechanics later on, like you can spear the sausages with your fork.
I wonder if you'd be able to do that.
It never actually changes the rules. The rules are consistent all the way through. It's just that until that point, you've never had a wall to push them against.
Yeah, I was wondering if it was to do with walls, because I haven't encountered any levels that have a sort of an extra dimension. Yeah. It's all been...
So I think they lock that off till later, and I think there's a whole bunch of other mechanics like that where it's just like...
I've climbed a ladder as well, but I had sort of do a weird like shuffle to get back down and be facing a weird direction that I wasn't quite
I wanted to climb a ladder, but I guess I didn't try forwards. I assume my fork would block me if I went forwards, and if I went backwards, then you can't climb
I don't
backwards.
Remember. I think I had to do it somehow sideways, but that might just be some sort of hallucination on my part. I don't remember, but although I still haven't managed to do the first two levels I encountered, I'm sort of doing this weird thing where I seem to have skipped those because my mind just went, well, these are clearly impossible, and then went on to something that I assumed would be more difficult, and then I think it clicked in my brain, like, oh, I can push this way, and I can
it really
do a weird concertina effect with the shoving the sausages around.
It completely lacks any kind of introductory level. There's not even the most basic. There's a signpost that tells you the controls, but then every level you go into is genuinely hard right from the start. There's nothing to lead you in, and that actually I found really off-putting at first because I'd heard it. You know, every level seems impossible, but I wasn't even getting that. I was just looking at level and just thinking, I don't even know what I'm supposed to do. I know in theory I've got to cook the sausage, but I don't know like if you put a sausage and two grill tiles on a level with infinite open space, I don't know if that's solvable. I don't know if there's any way to do that because I've just haven't had a chance to play around those mechanics at all. I don't know, can you ever turn a sausage round? Can you ever like if it's in certain phase so that like it's, you know, side A will always touch the grill when it rolls over, is there any way to get it out of that phase? And so basic rules like that, I didn't know. Like, is there something I can do with my fork that will in some way move the sausage in some particular way?
I think I didn't quite get that, but I had the thing that kicked in slightly after that. So I would get into a level, think, okay, I'm just going to keep, you know, prodding at things and finding things out until I see how you solve this. And because if you get the game over screen, you can go back a move. You can use Z to go back. So it's not like if you get the game over screen, everything is lost. You can still just backtrack and backtrack which I really liked. But I got... So I would sort of go in thinking, oh, this will probably be possible. And then I would sort of have played around for a while and then just be thinking... Is there something I haven't tried to get this to work rather than knowing that I had the full moveset available to me? If that makes sense. Like I was looking for the thing that would tell me you've exhausted the moveset. So now you just need to employ all of those things to find the solution, rather than be wondering if I was wasting time and having not discovered the thing that made it possible, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But that's probably more about how other games treat the player than it is about that game in particular.
I've had... I haven't really sort of clicked with it totally. I've had a couple of satisfying levels where I sort of planned out my solution. Mm. But most of the time, because there's so many different things you can do, like all the complexity that... You know, the ridiculous thing about it was it sounded so simple and everyone kept saying it was the deepest, most complicated thing ever. And it all kind of comes from the fork and the fact that as you turn, it still hits things. Mm. And so that lets you, there are certain moves you can do that don't make, that you wouldn't be able to do in another soccer band style game. Like if you're standing diagonally to a sausage and you turn your fork round, not only does it push it, but it pushes it kind of left rather than, you know, forwards because of the direction of your fork. And so there's like, for any given
you're sort of configuration, spotting
it. Yeah, there's loads of different moves you can do. Loads of different ways you can kind of nudge the sausages. But I've, because of that, it means that the possibility space is too complex for me to, like, I've never had a level where I just look at it and say, oh, I need to do this, this, and this, and then that.
Mm.
So I always do a few experimental moves. And then after just two or three random moves, you're in a situation that's, you know, one of a 2,000 you could be in.
Yeah.
And so from there, I sometimes... Sometimes I can see, oh, if I do this, I'll probably cook this sausage because you've got to cook it in four different ways. Like there's, it's two tiles long and it has two sides. So there's four different bits of it that need cooking. And, often there's more than one sausage. And sometimes it's just useful to, just figure out how to cook one sausage. And then from there, see, have I made the other one impossible now or, can I do it? And so I kind of just take a few experimental steps, see a way to do one thing that's good. Like, oh, I can cook this one part of the uncooked sausage and then often see, oh, now I fucked myself. I can't ever get that back. So undo that and then try it again and then get it right. And then, you know, one time out of four, I'll just see, oh, I can do it from here. I just need to push that sausage over here and now I can see it's done. And that's kind of satisfying, but I feel like I'm missing the point. Like the witness, when it teaches you, when it sets up a puzzle to teach you a mechanic, it's so clear. Like the, given your current understanding of how the mechanic works, it's completely impossible. Therefore, this new rule must be true. And therefore you just do it. And even before you do it, you kind of know it's going to work because it's so, it pairs it down so much. Whereas this is so sprawling and complex that whatever the new rule I was supposed to learn on that level, I didn't really learn it. I just kind of nudged things around until I saw a way to solve the level. And then I solved the level.
I think that's why I like the combination of reset entirely and go back one step by one step by one step. And that's why, because I'll play around with things and then I'll suddenly realize the step that I missed. So being able to just go back rather than to reset the entire thing and then have to figure out how I got there in the first place and then at what point it went wrong.
Yeah, I think that's the test is if you could hit reset and do the puzzle again, no problem, then you understand it. Whereas if you just sort of muddled into the solution, then like most of the time I would not want to hit reset at the end of the end. Like if I've done it correctly and then you ask me to do it again, I'd be like, fucking hell, I don't know. I just sort of stumbled into it.
Because I sort of found that once I'd started thinking in the right spatial terms, that I think I would be able to not necessarily do it perfect first time again, but I know the theory of the thing that I'm doing. So I was watching Chris try a level earlier, and as he was playing it, I was thinking, I see what I need to do. I just can't quite, like, and when I then went to it afterwards, I was able to get a lot further, but I still haven't quite found the key to finishing the thing, but it does to me feel like I'm making that progress. And in a weird way, it reminded me of when you were talking about Spelunky and how you feel like, even though it's and the sense of progress, whereas if you're playing something that makes you repeat things over and over again, it doesn't feel progress. And so for me, this sort of thing is like, it doesn't feel like rote learning, and that makes me feel like there's a lot more freedom for me to actually sort of be in that space and play around with things and to not get bored or tired or frustrated or just think, I don't know how to do this. It actually makes me feel like I can play with it more.
Yeah. There are two things I really like about the sort of undo system and failure, which is, it's quite common for puzzle games, I guess, to have a sort of unlimited undo, which is brilliant. But also, so you can reset and you can undo. And it even works so that if you reset and then realize, shit, I didn't mean to reset, you can undo the reset and go back to, and then still undo all of your previous moves as well.
Oh, that's cool. I hadn't tried that yet.
And then there's also a thing that a feature that I wanted and then realized is already in there, which is I would like, because there's multiple sausages often, and sometimes you're trying to focus on one sausage, as always in life. and like, I don't care if I fuck up this other one. I don't care if it gets burned. I don't care if it gets pushed into the sea. I just want to see if I can I ever cook the other one. Mm. And then if I can figure out a solution for that, then I can figure out how the other one fits around it. But if you, as soon as you burn one, it says game over. And as soon as you push one into the sea, it says game over. But it turns out you can just carry on playing behind that. The message will be on screen, but you can keep experimenting with, you know, okay, I fucked it up, but could I still get this other one to work? Because I was, when I thought the game over was actually stopping me from playing, I was thinking, oh, they should have like a different screen that says, you know, you can't complete it from here, but feel free to carry on, which is what Morrowind does when you kill a plot critical character.
You've killed a plot critical sausage.
The message in Morrowind is, with this character's death, the thread of the prophecy is broken. Continue in this doomed world or reload a previous save.
They should take that exactly.
Exactly. With the death of this sausage, the prophecy is broken.
Continue in this doomed world.
I tell you what, though, I'm glad that I wasn't sort of tasked with reviewing it for the deadline or anything, because it's like one of those games where you feel like it's possible to just get completely stuck and not not have the mental time to approach it naturally, like, you know, to make those mistakes and then to go away for an afternoon and then to come back. And
weirdly, the first review was on Destructoid, and it came out 2 weeks before the game came out. I would have thought this is a game where you want to give the reviewers as much time as possible.
Maybe they were just brilliant at it.
Yeah, yeah. I think the guy was, you know, 10 out of 10. Absolutely loved it.
I'm brilliant at this. 10 out of 10.
But yeah, I'm just really enjoying it, and I just really like that it's this complicated thing, but it's in this really lo-fi world.
Yep.
Like, and also the sound effects are just delightful. Like the sizzling of the sausages and the, like, the ow if you step on the grill.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah, all of that kind of stuff.
It's That's another, cool. like, really, there are so many little weird quirks to it. So, like, if there's a gap between you and a sausage, then you can't poke it.
Yeah.
Even with your fork, even though your fork extends over the gap. But if there's a grill between you and the sausage, you can't step on it. But when you try, you'll poke the sausage and then step back.
Yeah.
So you kind of like momentarily step on it and then go, ah, and then...
And draw back. And it's like some of them are only soluble? Solvable? Is soluble the word?
I think soluble technically...
I'm going to say solvable.
Yeah, solvable's safer.
But I think that only... That's, you know, obviously nothing in there is in there by accident because it's so pared down. And,
yeah.
Stephen's that kind of developer.
I actually did figure out a puzzle using that knowledge.
Yeah.
Like, I thought, look, there's this little, like, peninsula sticking out from this. There's...
Yes.
My current solution doesn't use that. Therefore, I'm doing the wrong thing. I should, like, at some point, I've got to stand there because I must have to prod a sausage from that angle.
Or if there's, like, a single tile off to one side, you're like, well, that's key to this whole thing, and I have no idea how.
Just think, if you wanted to be a huge dickhead, you can make a game like this with like an overworld, freeform overworld, individual puzzles, and just make one of the puzzles impossible.
Yeah.
Make it not critical to success, so you could still finish all of the solvable puzzles in the game, but have an area that's blocked off behind a puzzle that isn't possible.
But that's why you're a jerk.
Yeah. Just put it in there and see how much time of people's lives you waste.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a crime. Should that be a crime? An open question.
Excuse me. Another thought about this is that with the title... Stephen Lavelle has joined the ranks of Sid Meier and co. of putting their name in there.
Yeah, I didn't really read it that way.
Stephen's Tom Clancy's sausage roll.
Before long, we'll get Sid Meier's sausage roll.
Rolling sausages around the division.
Yeah.
That would be good. I haven't really played the division. Maybe that's obvious. Just thinking about
that sounds
sausages.
Better. I'll get in trouble again. You were going to talk about Cradle?
Yes, I was. Because that's the other thing that I've been playing this week. It came out last year, I think. And if memory serves, it's by a Ukrainian team. And what it is it's kind of a puzzle game, but also a speculative fiction game set on the Mongolian steppe, and you are in a yurt, and, you have a lot of stuff that you can explore within the yurt. There's a lot of text. There's a lot of, like newspaper clippings that you can read, and photos with like stuff on the back, and, like little artifacts that you can pick up and sort of chuck around. And there's also a sort of, a deactivated cyborg woman who is also a flower vase. And so what you're trying to do is work out who you are and why you're there, and just sort of more about the world and this mysterious building that's nearby. And the rest of it is like sort of this beautifully bleak landscape that just extends away from you. And I think it might sound really weird, but one of the things that kept me playing was, it's got this extraordinary sky with these weirdly stylized clouds. And I just sort of spent a good 15 minutes just wandering the wilderness, screenshotting it. But it just keeps you within these, two main spaces, and you fulfill little tasks. And some of them are sort of quite point and click adventure-y things where you're sort of looking for objects or trying to sort of, combine things in, you know, with other things to solve a particular puzzle or task or solution or whatever. And then other bits that I think is a lot more polarizing is, you also encounter these block puzzles, and I really like them. But when I posted about it on RPS, there is so much sort of in the comments of people just being like, oh yeah, thank God you could skip those puzzles if you fail them a couple of times or whatever. And yeah, because they do relate to the game, but they are so different from the aesthetic of what you're doing, and it does feel really jarring. And so you do gradually find out more about them, but I can see why people kind of saw them and just went, nah. Have either of you played?
No, I think was John Roberts talking about it, or maybe it was Marsh.
Maybe Marsh.
I remember someone has played it on the podcast, but not us.
Oh, okay. But yeah, it's kind of this, I just really loved it. It's this wonky thing that I really wouldn't recommend to everyone, in the same way that I wouldn't recommend Deadly Premonition to everyone. But they're both sort of that wonky, earnest, really joyful if you are in the right mind space for them games. So yeah, if you're interested in speculative fiction and transhumanism, then
and yurts
and yeah, because it's also just a sort of an unusual setting as well, and sort of a weird art style, which I really liked.
Lovely yurts.
How about you? What have you been playing?
Me?
Years.
I've still been playing Dark Souls, I'm afraid. I'm not, the lack of a Tom Senior will prevent this from becoming a further hour-long back and forth about the relative merits of different camera positions when stabbing a big metal dog in the bum. I sort of appreciate it. I listened back to last week's pod, and I think I was probably a bit harsher on it than I intended. Because I do think it's amazing. Like, it's they've gotten better and better at making an already amazing game. And I'm now maybe 15 hours into it, where I was 2 hours last time. And it's getting, you know, better and better. And there's all sorts of things to appreciate about the way the combat system changed, and amazing level design, and some just brilliant bits of, also maybe to return to the point that we were talking about last week about difficulty, and whether or not this is a kind of game that benefits from easy mode. Something I really come to love about Dark Souls is the way it organically gets easier as you get better at things, and how it rewards you for maybe taking the initiative and exploring and investigating parts of the game you might not have already seen by making something else easier. So, you know, that's often your reward for going down a path that maybe is not critical path for you right now, or for if you have two different branches on the critical path that you can go down, sort of exploring them both a little bit, is you'll find one thing in one of those two paths that makes the other one easier. So you still have that initial experience of going, oh, what the fuck is this? But you go the other direction, you'll find something. So if you back away from, if you go into the challenge and you overcome it, great, you overcame the challenge. But if you back away from it and start moving in a different direction, one of your rewards for doing that isn't simply bypassing a hard thing. It's you find a new shield that protects you from the thing that it was you were finding hard about the other path. Like, it's full of intricate bits of design like that. It's really, really nice. It's also still got some of that mad magic weirdness to it. And I wanted, there's two different stories I can tell from my first week of it that highlight this. One is both of them revolve around multiplayer, which is kind of a spoiler for the first story, actually, because I hadn't realized, actually. So in every Dark Souls game, including Bloodborne, there's your character is in one of two states at any given time. In Dark Souls 1, you're either human or hollowed. In this, you're either ashen or embered, enkindled. Like, you're literally on fire. Like, in Dark Souls 3, you're either a little bit on fire or you're not on fire at all.
So are these in the same worlds, then?
Yeah. It's just your character is in either one of two states.
But, like, why aren't you hollow if you're not in Dark Souls land?
You're not the chosen undead. You're not hollow, you're ashen. Which is important if you're into words and associated religious concepts involving fire. You are a champion of ash in Dark Souls 3, whereas it's actually functioning the same system. So in Dark Souls 1, because I haven't finished. Yeah, I'm actually not
okay,
fully.
Yeah.
It's Dark Souls. It doesn't tell you this is why it's
different. No, but it was interesting to me that maybe these games are sort of spiritually linked, but not linked in terms of the actual location or anything else. Like, I never had a handle on that.
The Dark Souls series. Well, so as far as I can tell now, Dark Souls 2 is the outlier. Mm. Where it's not quite so clear. Dark Souls 3 explicitly links to Dark Souls 1.
Bloodborne in the Dark Souls universe?
No.
Okay.
No, so Bloodborne is an example of the same sort of system existing, I think. Does it? Yes. Is it? I can't even fucking remember.
Because you live in, like, the land of Yordle or something.
Yeah. Why not? Sure. The land of Yordle. Yordran, the Yand of the Yords. That's a joke. That's a Dark Souls joke.
Okay.
But what I'm getting at is, so you have a, in Dark Souls 1, it's humanity, and the difference is when you are human, you're much more connected to the multiplayer side of the game. So you can summon co-op help from other players, you can be invaded by other players, and so on. When you die, you go back to being hollow. In Dark Souls 3, that's being enkindled or something. And you're literally just a bit on fire. Like, your character model is a bit on fire. You don't become more human, which is what happened in Dark Souls 1, where you kind of get your skin back and the rest of the time you're a zombie. In this, you kind of still look like a kind of horrible, decrepit, fungal, zombie skeleton person, but you're now just a little bit on fire. And you get more health for being a little bit on fire. But you can also be, you know, invaded and so on. And so when I've been playing it previously, I hadn't really seen the significance of this, simply because actually I was an idiot and it wasn't obvious to me what was happening. But then I'm running around new area and I see, you know, various summon signs on the ground that I don't usually use them, but I'm used to there being sort of two types of summon signs. There's literally summon another player, and it's usually really obvious because you click them and it's like, do you wish to summon, you know, Sniper Hitler 420? And you're like, yes.
Of course.
It's obvious that you're summoning an NPC character that you've already met. So when you...
Like that Sun Guy.
Yes. Sun Guy. Everyone's favourite Dark Souls character.
Look, I got as far as the first bell.
Yeah. Then you definitely encountered Sun Guy.
Yeah. I think I had him help me with a gargoyle. Does that sound
yes,
right?
Yes, perhaps even two gargoyles. Yeah.
Oh, I must have dealt with both of them then.
Yes,
because that was the end of the roof.
That was the end of the roof.
That classic moment.
Good old Sun
the
Guy.
The end of the roof with the Sun Guy.
And his classic catchphrase, I love the sun, mate.
Sun's good.
Yeah. Hooray for sun, he says. Kids love the sun.
Yes.
So a little bit like summoning Sun Guy, you can do that. And, you know, there's just like a colour difference. I think having skipped Dark Souls 2, I wasn't quite as aware of like how many different forms of multiplayer they'd added to that series. So I'm running around and I see a purple summon sign, which I've never seen before. And it says, summon Mad Phantom. And it has a name like, it was I was like, cool, yeah.
Sure.
And it says, are you sure? So this is a mad...
party started.
Mad Phantom? Like, yeah, summon Mad Phantom. And it was just a knight, like yeah. A knight. And it looked... And the name was, like, very much a believable Dark Souls name, no. Right?
Okay.
So I was like, I was running around, and I was like, oh, this guy's AI is really good. This is going to make me sound stupider and stupider as this goes on. But so I'm exploring the area and I'm doing really well. And this guy's helping me. And I'm like, I'm keeping an eye on him just in case it's like the AI is programmed to like trick. So I'm completely convinced it's an NPC. Yeah. Just in case the AI is programmed to like switch over and after a certain point and attack you or something. So I'm kind of keeping him in view. But we clear out a big area. There's a bit that was seemed a bit weird where he ran ahead into an area where enemies are throwing like firebombs down at you. And he seemed to just enjoy doing forward rolls around so they don't hit with the firebombs. So I'm like, this AI is great. And the more story the more I tell the story, the stupider I seem. So we go all the way through this, area down a hill and around a corner and we're killing these enemies. We go through a sewer and there's a scary bit of fog and I can tell that there's like probably a big monster in the sewer. And then, my AI companion walks slowly into the fog and I hear this like crunch and you can see health bars vanish even if you can't see the enemy that's attached to them. So I see this thing and I get a load of souls from it and I'm like, oh, he killed the monster for me. Isn't it amazing that they scripted this NPC companion so that at that particular point he would know specifically how to walk slowly into the fog so he didn't get ambushed by the thing in the fog because it was a real person. And so I run around the corner and I get to a bonfire, find a bonfire, brilliant. And this NPC then like, waves and vanishes. And I'm like, cool. What a great NPC companion this was. But at that point, I see another purple phantom, but this time with an equally believable name, and it's called Mad Phantom something something, but this time the name is Red, and he's just running straight at me. And I'm like, oh shit, I guess this is the way this NPC-based system works, where you summon one, maybe if you get a good one, then after you've used the good one for a while, you get attacked by a bad one. And so I get in a duel with this thing and I'm like, wow, this guy's switching weapons a lot more than a regular NPC character does in Dark Souls. But they do that, so it's fine. I kill him, at which point I'm like, what a great encounter against the computer that was. At which point, I'm on Twitter like the next morning and these characters belong to a particular, like they had the same title, like it was like, because every time people are going to play the game, I won't tell you the words just so you can, maybe people can counter that. But like, they were obviously members of the same organization. And someone tweeted, I ended up retweeting it, like this long story about someone's encounter with players who are members of this player organization. And what they do is they are co-op summons. So you summon them into your game, to help you, but they don't get their reward for their particular covenant that they've joined unless they betray you at the end of it and kill you and take away the souls that you've taken or something like that. Like, and so suddenly this NPC experience I'd had the night before was complete, framed in a completely different light where I found this guy and we played together for like an hour and he didn't betray me. Like he had every opportunity to betray me. He could have let me walk into that fog by myself and get ambushed, but he did it all for me and then he left. Which was really awesome. And then at the end, because I was open to summons, then I got attacked by a genuine asshole who I then defeated. So like I'd had like a PvP encounter without realizing that's what happening. And I think, honestly, I don't know if that's a magical repeatable circumstance because I genuinely think you have to be a moron, particularly if you've played two other Dark Souls games to the point where you know that this can happen.
Yeah.
And that still happens. So that was legitimately stupid of me.
If only they could pull the inverse trick where you genuinely believe every single NPC in the game is controlled by a human. You're like, yeah. Wow, this is amazing. It's all these thinking people.
It does, like, one of the things that's really magical about Dark Souls is that it's significant when you encounter enemies that obey the same rules that human players do. Because when you die or when you return to a bonfire to rest, it respawns all the enemies in an area. That's like one of your Dark Souls' key mechanics. Is one of the reasons it's such a big deal to find shortcuts is everything respawns. If something doesn't, that meant it was quote unquote real. So that was like, and so it uses that trick of like respawning enemies to teach you like, you just killed a real person, even if it was actually an NPC, because they behave the same way as a player summoned would. You get attacked by people that use the same combat abilities as players, roll around, you switch their weapons, throw things at you, all the stuff that players can do. And those characters will be presented to you as having been in some way more human than the sort of shambling monsters that you're fighting the rest of the time. So it does use it for a purpose, which is really clever. The other story is kind of two sides to it. So basically, I've now joined a covenant myself, and I'm not going to say very much about it other than for as long as I'm sort of like wearing the badge of that covenant.
Are you in the Masons?
It's kind of a bit like that, yeah.
It's the first rule of the covenant not to talk about the covenant.
I just want to spoil it for people. I'm telling people what area it is because you kind of want to encounter this stuff for the first time. But this is similar enough to something that I know was in Dark Souls 2 that you sort of say it. Basically, there's a particular area that you fight through the first time. And while you're in there, if you are a little bit on fire, because I genuinely don't remember what that's called, you can be attacked by other players. And this had happened to me, and I died to it twice, I think. And that's because essentially other players can become guardians of this particular area. And that means if you're repping that covenant, at any point you can be pulled out of what you're doing and sent to guard this area from the player that's in there. So it's a way of adding challenge to that area. In addition to being a dangerous area, there's also the chance that a player will just jump you because they are then they've become like the guardians of it. And even though I'd been beaten up by these assholes a couple of times, I decided to become one. And so unfortunately, the first time I got summoned, I was really excited because I'd never really actually invaded anyone before. But it's not like a hostile invade because it's more like they invaded your territory kind of thing. But unfortunately, the netcode had obviously wigged out, and it was representing other players to me at all times as like flying T-pose, like animation T-pose, where they're in the kind of default arms outstretched animation. Yeah. And I got into a fight with a guy that was completely impossible because I couldn't see how he was standing. That's such a big deal in Dark Souls. I could see when he switched weapons because it swapped whatever was in the default animation mesh. But so that was a bit immersion breaking. But then it happened again. So I get into this area. And I know the area really well now. And if you are defending it as a phantom, none of the enemies that are in the area are aggressive. You can go through and they are all completely, I'll say there's some very, very big crabs, put it that way. And the big crabs are fine with you you should be there. And so I'm running around and I'm trying to find this person and I can't, like at all. And I know the area quite well. So I go up to the bonfire and they're not there. And there are also enemies everywhere. And so what I'm doing is looking to see who's dead. Because they can't have got... after they've been invaded, I don't believe they can go back to a bonfire. Which means they couldn't respawn the enemies in a given area. If they go too far in a given direction, they will aggro something. And they will either have to fight it, in which case I'll either see them fighting it, find its body, or they'll be dead. So, you know, there's a limited possibility space based on, like, what could possibly have happened. But there are a lot of enemies around. And I can find a trail of bodies near the first bonfire in that area, and then around it is fine. There is another bonfire, so there's a chance that they could have started at the other bonfire and gone in a different direction. So I'm just running around, like exploring all the different paths from a given place. And then I realized, okay, they have to be in this area. And then I remembered that the first time I got invaded while I was in that area, I used an item that you can get relatively early on, definitely would have by the time you got here, which allows you to just look like a box. You can just look like a crate for a while. If you ever played Prop Hunt for TF2, it's basically Prop Hunt. And I was like, I pretended to be a box for like 20 minutes last time. And so I run around. I'm like, okay, so I sort of narrow it down to like where they could possibly be, but a box would really stand out and I can't see a box. And then I run and I'm like, okay, so you could kill the enemies here, then you could skirt the edge of the level and not aggro anything else until you got to this point. And I turn a corner and there's like a little hill. And then behind a tree, I just see a crate, like, duck back behind a tree. And I'm like, got you, fucker. So I, like, start running at this, like, my you know, two-handed katana drawn, like, charging at this box, which then turns into a human woman and, like, dives towards me. And we have this amazing sword fight. And Dark Souls has an amazing combat system, so it's really dramatic when you're fighting someone that took ages. Like, genuinely, every weapon and consumable spent against each other. Because we're in this situation where, like, we're fighting, and as the invader, I have fewer health regeneration resources than the invadee does. And I run out of mine before she runs out of hers. So when she's sort of done her last top up, I'm like on half health, and it's really cagey. And she's found a strategy that worked for her, but I'm mixing up mine, like whether you block, do power attacks, try and break shield, all this stuff, detailed combat system. And I start to lose, so I just walk backwards, and she starts to chase me. And then this aggro is a really, really big crab. But the crabs have like a limited aggro leash. They're one of the few enemies that doesn't necessarily go beyond a certain point. So we get to this impasse where it's like, if I wanted to be a dick, I can force you to fight me in Crab Town. if I don't, because you have to get past me to keep progressing. Like, you have to deal with, because I can chase you. If you try and go off and do the boss at the end of the level or explore an area you haven't seen to, I will hunt you down and fight you while you're fighting something else and ruin your day. But I decided not to be a dick. I was like, okay, I'm going to step out of crab land. And I'm sort of facing this person down. And they, like, do a bow. And then I do a bow and resume on the sword duel for a bit. And then when I get injured, I will back into crab territory. And this thing went on for, like, half an hour of, like, just this, you know, complete... Like, I don't think... I was struggling. I was low on health, so I couldn't... I was, you know, trying to fight them head on was, like, incredibly high risk. But they obviously couldn't do anything if I... They couldn't risk fighting me in aggro radius or something else. And eventually I sort of went all in on something and got like they switched to a dagger and like pinned me into a corner and murdered me with knives, which I probably fully deserved for having like taken over like 25 minutes of this person's experience of the game at that point. But I think an experience like that has kind of nothing to do with how difficult the game is, even though it in and of itself is a difficulty enhancing mechanic that this particular area you have to deal with this thing in it. But it kind of explains like why it's such a cool thing, like, so unlike any other game.
I like that idea of like signing up to guard an area. Yeah. Like, just most of the time you're the player and you're fighting against the enemies, and you decide, I kind of believe in the guards of this area. I believe in the giant crabs. I think they have a right to defend this, and I'll sign up to.
to protect, to be the protector of the giant crabs. The
crabs, you just let me know. Someone else comes around here, so fuck fucking the shit. I'll be here.
The crabs are really, maybe mentioning the crabs has kind of given away which area it is, so fuck it. But crabs are a huge problem in Dark Souls, because Dark Souls is always all about stabbing things in the bum.
Is it a seaside game?
No.
Okay.
There's a beautiful shot of the ocean at some point, though. Because crabs move sideways, which is a real problem if you want to stab something in the bum, because they're very hard to get around, because they run away in a way that doesn't expose their ass to you, which is like the most overpowered thing you can do in Dark Souls, really. Other than that, the best thing about it remains the messages players write to each other.
Yeah, I was going to ask if that still existed. Like the whole definitely jump off this ledge. Yeah.
No dragon ahead is the gif I saw.
Yeah, no dragon ahead is a good one.
I've seen you're only allowed to pick from a certain pool of words, aren't you? Yeah.
There's a recurring enemy which a real pain in the ass. They're like treasure goblins from Diablo. They're a beetle, which will drop like a really precious weapon upgrade item if you can catch and kill it. But as soon as it sees you, it will run and then vanish. And you can go back to a bonfire and try it again. But there's one that's a real pain in the ass, and in front of it, I found a message on the floor, which was something like, "Looks like beetle. Oh, but if I had a beetle." Just to tell everything, because you have to construct it out of these preset phrases, and you can do like preset phrase word, or you can do preset phrase word conjunction preset phrase word. So I was trying to do one to genuinely be helpful, which is like, extinguish this fire, don't miss this thing that's over here. And so the only thing I find to do it would be like, looks like fire, and then looks like dark. And this whole thing of like,
it's like charades.
Yeah, sounding slightly like idiots is awesome. There's it kind of isn't a spoiler at this point in a Souls game to say that there is a shit poison swamp, because there is always a shitty fucking poison swamp. And I think to the point where for From Software it's becoming a running joke that like you get to the bit where it's like, hope you have poison resistance gear because you're running through a shitty fucking swamp. It's Blighttown again. So as soon as I got into the area, someone had written, looks like swamp. This again. And like upvoted like 150 times.
They're kind of like Dark Souls, not haikus, but it is Dark Souls poetry, I guess.
Yeah, it is. And people find different ways to say things. So you can, you know, someone can just write, try jumping, where if there's like a secret you can get to. But someone else will write, time for legs. And it's often enough to just make you think about, like, what could they fucking possibly mean?
I don't follow any of those because I don't trust any of them.
There's a kind of camaraderie.
I'd follow time for legs.
Yeah.
To the best of my ability.
I think I found out what the new smart ass thing to do is.
Right. Because
like every game has had its meme phrase. So Dark Souls 2 was sadness, but hooray for skeleton, which you would draw near any skeleton in the game.
Okay. What was the original Dark Souls?
I can't remember now. I don't think I was into it enough to know. But so you can just type a single word if you want.
Yeah.
And one of the words can be message. Like you can just write the word message. But when you see the like the glowing orange text on the ground, the button prompt is press A to read message. So you're like, oh, I see what you did there, you dickheads. It's like, you know, I am serious and don't call me.
Surely.
Message. Yeah. Anyway, that's Dark Souls. It's extremely good. Mm-hmm. But if you didn't, I guess if you didn't like a previous game like this, then you would not like this.
I wish there was a way for me to enjoy it and to get what you get out of it without being any good at the combat and understanding enemies.
Yeah, we talked about this a little.
Yeah, I remember, but it was kind of like, I don't have an answer for how you do that either. Because it's not a difficulty thing, it's just a kind of, in a way, I wish that there was a different engagement mechanic that I could master to give the same drip feed of resources and information and all of that stuff. So instead of it being a combat-related thing, it was another thing that similarly gated the experience.
That would basically be the witness.
Well, yeah, but in a way that I could understand. And yeah, so that would be my solution for that, I guess. But again, that's like you have to design an entirely different game.
You have to do a Sudoku against every boss in the game.
Solitaire.
Yeah, exactly. Regency Dark Souls. Tom, what have you been playing? And are you all right?
Yes. Sorry about my hiccups. Other than Steven Sausage Roll, I did play Deadbolt, which is out now. I've talked about it before, but back then there was just a sort of free public demo of it that was much like a kind of shareware version, you know, like when Doom was first released. It was like the first chapter was free, which was like 10 levels or something. And so that was about the same with Deadbolt. And it's a game about side-on stealth action game where you're death and you are shooting zombies with guns. And it's very like one headshot kills. Anyone shooting you at all kills you, I think.
Do you get a crossbow? Is that what the pun is?
No.
Oh. I thought, like, because Deadbolt. Like,
pretty sure you don't get a crossbow. The main difference between the demo bit that I played is and the full game is that there is now, obviously, after the first series of missions against zombies, you kill, like, their boss, which is called Lil Puff. they're also drug-dealing zombies, and I think the reason you kill them is because you're death, and so the fact that they're not dead is annoying to you.
It's annoying, yeah.
But then after that, you also kill vampires, and I guess that's a similar kind of thing.
What's it called? Conker's Bad Fur Day, which I appreciate, again, not a PC game, but the Grim Reaper in that was called Greg, and he had a real anger towards cats because of the whole Nine Lives thing. Like, they were defying him. So I'm guessing there's a similar thing with the undead that's like, oh, for God's sake.
Vampires in Deadbolt can walk on the ceiling. And this is, like, they don't sort of hang or, like, crawl. They just literally, their normal patrolling animation is just upside down.
Oh, okay.
Which is kind of great. And their chapter, like, has a load of nightclubs and stuff, and dancing vampires won't attack you unless you attack them.
It's true.
There's a song called Dancing on the Ceiling. Is this the reference? I'm just looking for the pun.
No, they actually, as far as I've seen, they never dance on the ceiling. They're only, like, the ones on the ceiling are actually active vampires who might shoot you.
Then
the dance floor is on the ground. They have vampire clubs, but they're not going to get too wacky. Yeah.
It's not a dance ceiling. Come on.
It's quite like great, it's got sorry. Really satisfying gunplay. When you shoot someone and like their head explodes and it leaves a splatter on the wall, makes really good noises. You can go through piping, like you just turn into a gas and go through ventilation systems and plumbing. then it's like each individual encounter is really good, and like planning out your approach and stuff is really good. But it has no kind of save system. And so if you... The last time I played it, I kind of rage quit, and I'm not totally sure I'm going to go back to it, because it was a vampire level, a big, like, I don't even know if it was a nightclub, but it had some dancing vampires in it, I think. And then you've got like, you know, 16 targets or something to take out, maybe more. And you have to be very methodical, and there's all different parts of the building. It's quite a big building, kind of segmented off. And I'd methodically taken out, you know, the first four and done that perfectly, done the next four perfectly, and then like, there's only one group of enemies left that weren't dancing, and therefore I had to actually worry about. And, I came up to them. I went through a sewer, or just the plumbing of the toilet to get outside back to where I started, because they were just behind the front door. And I went up to the front door, and some doors in Deadbolt you can knock on and manually open or close. Mm. And that's a kind of tactical thing. Some doors, for some reason, swing open when you touch them. And I had forgotten what those two kinds of doors looked like. And so I walked right up to it, thinking I was going to knock on it or maybe ambush them or like surprise them. And it just opened because I touched it, and they all saw me and killed me. And because there's no save at all, I just meant I got to redo the entire level. And on short levels, I don't mind it, because there's always some scope to do it better or some scope to kind of, it's just satisfying to play. But I put in so much work on that, and I died to a fucking door, and I was just like, oh, screw this.
Sounds like it needs gunpoint save system.
Yep. Like all things. Should we do questions?
Yes.
Ooh, yes. Should I read them?
Okay. Yes.
Okay, so the first one is to questions. Oh, no, wait, that's the email address, I think. Anyway, moving on. Can we edit this bit out?
No.
Hi, podcast. I've been thinking about and listening to people think about the difficulty modes in games thing some, and the one aspect I found lacking was the accessibility angle. I think a game being completely inaccessible to someone because of a disability they have is always a big downside, and easy modes can be one tool to make games more accessible. Ideally, the disabled person could play a version that makes the game the right amount of challenging for them, and the able person could play the version that works for them. That's what I think the real challenge is, making the game the right amount of challenging for each player. I'm not sure that's possible, but I do think there's value in perusing difficulty modes in hopes of finding that. Thanks for reading, everybody. James. That was James Waltz Wrongberger, by the way.
Excellent.
Yeah. I think like an easy mode is quite a generic solution to that problem, because obviously like people have all kinds of different difficulties with playing games, and making the game just generally easier probably does help with a bunch of them. But things like, so, you know, color blindness is the most common one, I think, in terms of actual how many people have it. And just making the whole game easier doesn't necessarily solve that. You know, if the color blindness problem is that you simply can't tell where the success and failure zones are in a mini game, then making the rest of the game easier is kind of unwelcome and also doesn't help with that problem. But I do agree in general, like, you might as well have one. It's just, particularly, I think, time pressure stuff. If you're making any kind of game where it's possible to turn that off, then that's great, because anyone who has control issues can then, you know, take their time to get around their disadvantage there. And I think that's the thing that's probably hardest if you are, you know, using a sort of unconventional controller, or, you know, for whatever reason can't use the default controls. When you're also under time pressure, that's, you know, my tiny little like glimpse of this is like that I'm so shit at controlling mobile games because I have fat fingers and like my phone's tiny. And so anything, like, I literally just don't play anything on my phone that has time pressure, because I just can't control it well enough to do so.
Mm. I heard something where a game was, it was just a puzzle game. I think it was Lumino City, actually. And there was one part of it where it relied on you remembering different bits of a melody, and I struggled with that so bad. It was like running into a brick wall in terms of difficulty. I would just sort of have to repeat it over and over again. And I think in the end, I ended up just writing it down, like the relation of the notes to one another, to actually have a sense of how to piece this thing together that it was asking me to do. But it felt so out of keeping with the rest of the game, because it was this thing that I didn't seem to have a tool set in my brain to actually even cope with. And if the whole game had been that, I don't know what I would have done. And obviously that's sort of probably a really shitty analog in a lot of ways for somebody who's struggles with the very basics of controlling most PC gaming. Although actually I would say that that's something that I've spoken a lot about in terms of VR, because my hope with VR is that people will come up with more intuitive, more easy to handle control systems because of needing to operate them without actually being able to see them. So sort of having that intuitiveness and simplicity might actually be something that comes out of the VR boom and then feeds back into actually sort of having accessibility in terms of that side of things. But I guess it just depends. When you start talking about accessibility, you then have to get into what it is that people are finding difficult, and that will change on a person to person condition to condition basis.
It's such a complicated issue because ability is not defined by big fixed points of, you know, benefit or deficit in terms of motor control or anything like that. It genuinely is a spectrum with huge differences between every individual that plays a game, regardless of who they are. Mm. To maybe people who would be considered able-bodied might have totally different reaction times and find different things about games easy or hard based on that. Any given puzzle game, is different based on who you are. I am one of the people who's terrible at certain kinds of, like, particularly numeracy-based puzzles. I just can't fucking do them. My brain won't process the information, whereas you find them so naturally easy, Pip.
You've watched me over my shoulder and you're just like, well, how are you doing this?
Something that is autopilot for your consciousness. It just doesn't work in mine.
I do it to get to sleep. And just like,
can't do it.
You're an actual broken person right now to me. I was like,
oh. And that obviously extends right down the line. And I was thinking about this a lot when just, going through that question a little while ago. And I think it's actually quite a good case for flat difficulty levels, because beyond that, the task of trying to tailor a game experience to offer approximately the same experience for everyone who encounters it is flat out fucking impossible. Like, it's just never going to work. Everyone who plays Dark Souls currently, people who, in groups of people who like it, people who experience different parts of it differently. I am cautious about saying that those things are necessary in order to make the game accessible to people, simply because, I have, I'm sort of aware of the work that companies like Special Effect do to make games accessible from a control point of view to people, tailoring control systems for specific disabilities, normally when it comes to like motor control. But when those systems are in place, it's often amazing what people are capable of. Like, there was maybe a year ago now, I watched a guy solo a Destiny raid using only his chin and his elbow because he had no control over his hands. Mm. And I can't do that. Normally.
Yeah.
I can't do that, and I play a lot of that game. So, there's the question of, should there just be an easy mode for people? I think you probably bring in a lot more people and you include a lot more people, but what people are capable of in the context of games and what ability necessarily means in the context of games is such a wide-ranging thing that maybe the only good answer is, just to have, and I say this as someone who's opposed to multiple difficulties in Dark Souls, just to have an easy mode and maybe take the hit to the shared experience, because maybe the counter to the thing I said last week about a single difficulty level furnishing a shared experience is it isn't necessarily genuinely a shared experience of someone.
Well, something that I was wondering was maybe having something that lets you have that whatever an easier experience means in a given context, but sort of introducing that, but maybe just a bit down the line as well. So there's, that sort of people who want to catch up, or people who feel like they tried it and just couldn't get
after release
for whatever reason. Maybe a year later you'd actually be able to have that sort of second flush of, okay, well, I couldn't do it the way that the developers intended, or even necessarily maybe the way the developers could have afforded or scoped the project for at that point in time. But now they've rescaled it, or they made enough that they could add these two different modes in.
Yeah.
And I can sort of start picking through it in that way. I mean, obviously that, you know, there's different requirements, and then there's different sort of, you know, who do you scope for and how and why.
I think there's a reason that weirdly games get harder modes after they've come out rather than easier modes. And it's because the demand, the demand that developers can find evidence for what people actually want them to add to their game will come from people who liked the game the first time around. And so that will be, we want more stuff to do. We want harder stuff to do. We want harder bosses. We want a harder new game plus mode. It will never be, I didn't play this, find the mode that lets you play it. And that's actually not necessarily a good thing, but it's why I don't think that will happen.
Maybe it would for something like Souls, just because it has this such an enormous presence now, and so many people sort of write op-eds about how it's the greatest game, or how it's this incredibly meaningful, personal, amazing storytelling thing. And then, you know, there's so many people like me who look in on that from the outside and go, I can't ever experience that because it's gated in terms of my ability to deal with these fights, or my level of patience, or my my actual coordination when it comes to using the PlayStation pad, or, you know, things like that. Is,
but this is the thing, like, this is what's interesting about it. Like, and I'm not saying this is right, but observably, like, so the thing Dark Souls got famous for was its difficulty, and then the depth of its storytelling and the quality of its world and people's emotional reactions to it were either qualities that branched from difficulty, or they were not mentioned as much as difficulty was, to the point that when that petition was successful to get the game released on PC, which then coincided with the special edition, all of the marketing and the messaging and everything behind the game was based on difficulty. Like, suddenly the message is, it's called Dark Souls Prepare to Die Edition, and they put all of the weight they had. Like, perhaps in an alternate universe where that initial wave of, because bear in mind, Dark Souls came out, no one was expecting anything from it. No one had, very few people had played like the Kingsfield series or Demon Souls, which is the origin of From Software stuff. Everyone was sort of putting, and then suddenly this thing explodes in popularity, basically because it becomes an incredibly meaningful experience for essentially the first wave of reviewers who became huge advocates for it. But difficulty was the narrative. And so understandably, when the publisher came to make it more of a mass market proposition, difficulty was the thing, and it still is. That's why they're doing that stupid Dark Souls Hot Wings challenge. Like, what if you can't eat spicy food and you're a vegetarian? Like, you know, maybe it's a facetious point, but they are just fucking blocking you from, like, they've decided that what that game is about is this sort of super hardcore challenge. There's maybe an argument that if the first wave of people had gone, this is actually a really meaningful meditation on, you know, the divine right of kings and religion and how myths form, then that would have been the thrust of the subsequent marketing, and you'd get the Dark Souls Prepared to Think edition. But that's not what happened, and I think the likelihood of it is not happening. And it's not that those things shouldn't have happened, it's more that with Dark Souls particularly, I would worry that the boat has totally sailed on demand for Dark Souls Accessible Edition, which is not necessarily a good thing. It's just a thing.
There's so one problem with sort of making it an easy mode in games in general is that you're always kind of tempting some players to go for that, even when they don't have any particular, like, they might just try that to begin with to see if they like it, and then you get engrossed and you just forget that you ever picked easy mode. I don't actually ever remember picking a difficulty for Far Cry Primal, and apparently it does have difficulty modes, but I didn't even know it did, because I just whatever choice I made was unconscious. And so, like, I'm thinking about, you know, I'm making a game, and I'm thinking about, should I have a separate mode that's just kind of, it does have time pressure on it. It does have, like, right now it has moments that require skill under time pressure, and there are some people who really dislike that, and there are some people who just won't be able to cope with it if they're having trouble with controls. And so should I having, like, a separate mode where all of that stuff is turned off and all of the, you know, bunch of punishing things are turned off? And actually, I think probably the better thing to do, if I do that, a bunch of players who shouldn't play easy mode probably will play easy mode because they just want, you know, they're scared of difficulty. Something I found loads of Gunpoint is loads of people thought they wouldn't be able to play it. Loads of people saw that it involved complicated things and were just like, oh no, I can't do puzzle games. And then when they eventually did try it, found it way easier than they thought. But what you could do is have a kind of custom mode where, in fact, Invisible Ink does this, where you can sort of, it doesn't offer you any or at least the way I'm thinking of, is you don't offer them like a preset called an easy mode. You just say, if you would like to play a custom game, then you present them the option menu, and then there's like checkboxes for time pressure and checkboxes for, you know, do you want the ability to recover after you die? Do you want autosaves on and that kind of stuff? And then it's clear to the player that they are deciding to configure the experience to something different to what it's intended to be. But it's there if that's the only way you can get value from the game. And it's also there if you've already played it the main way and you've decided you want to play it in a different way. With Invisible Ink, I've used that. And for every given thing that I wanted to tweak about the game, they let me tweak it. And I tweaked it and I played it and thought, oh no, they were right to do it their way. Like everything I thought should be changed about Invisible Ink, I'm wrong. It should be the way they do it.
I think in like, certainly because I wasn't here when you were discussing this stuff last week, I think I'm trying to talk about both things at once in terms of the accessibility. So I don't want it to sound like I'm conflating my inability to deal with Dark Souls bosses with like somebody with a physical disability or anything like that. But sort of in, you know, as soon as you start trying to work out all of the different ways, individual players might need to have something tweaked in order to actually be able to get to grips with it. I do see how it becomes a huge sort of potentially endless proposition for a studio or a single developer to actually try and unpick. That doesn't mean to say that they shouldn't try, but I appreciate that that's such a sort of many tendrilled problem to approach as a sort of like trying to work out where you even start or sort of how you even present it once you have got some kind of solution in place or some kind of idea for how you might want to. That I'm not really going anywhere with that point, but just it's kind of this,
it's that's what I'm saying, like thing, it's such a big complicated problem that maybe just flat, easy, hard, medium is the way to do it. But even we can go in circles around this point for ages. I think there's so many.
I was just gonna say, in terms of my own thing with the Dark Souls thing, when you were saying about the marketing being about difficulty, have I ever said this on the podcast before? But I might have done, but it's basically that when I first arrived in Dark Souls land, because I had tried
your classic setting,
Yordle. Yeah.
I had tried Yordle land. Then I had tried to get a bit into the game, but this was about maybe a year or two before the successful dinging of the bell run. But that one, I went forwards and down after I'd talked to a big bird. And
oh yeah, Big Bird, the famous Dark Souls character.
So Big Bird pops in.
Big Bird of Yordle Land.
And you go in and down and you're in a graveyard and all of these hard as ball skeletons appear. And I was so kind of, I'd taken on board so much marketing that told me it was going to be incredibly difficult, and so many friends saying it was the hardest game they'd ever played, and, you know, all of this stuff, that I just assumed that that was what the experience was. And once I'd failed to defeat these skeletons for hours and hours and hours, I was so miserable and bored and angry that I gave up on the entire endeavor. And it was only when I came to it again, and one of my friends was like, you can just go a different direction. You know that, right? And I was like, well, no, why would I have? Because this game was billed as this incredibly difficult experience. So I ran up against an incredibly difficult experience, couldn't do it, couldn't get any further with it. And it felt like that was where the game was like funneling me. So I, you know, and they're like, but did you not see the bell? I'm like, no, clearly I didn't. I wasn't paying attention. There was a bird. So the whole thing was, that was more just about the messaging of the marketing, though, than the actual question.
You know, no, it counts. Right?
But yes, thank you, James. Shall we go on to another one? Well, right. So, dear fail state and health bar, says Daniel Norton.
That's pretty good.
I'm not really interested in Devil Daggers because ultimately there's no win state beyond not dying, and bragging rights on the leaderboard doesn't interest me. So, question. How do you feel about score chases?
Love them.
Have you ever played a game longer than you might otherwise to beat a friend's score?
Yes.
And how about to beat a stranger's score?
Also, yes.
Cheers for the lovely podcast. Last week's missing episode left a sad hole in my playlist.
Oh.
Poor Daniel.
I don't go in for competitive games, but I have been lured by this into certain things. Just Cause 3 keeps telling you every single thing you do, it'll just say, like, oh, your friend did that better. Your friend did that for longer. Your friend did that slightly. And then just wingsuiting time. Flying in a wingsuit, and it's time doing that without hitting anything or landing or stopping or parachuting or doing anything else. And often, like, wingsuiting is very fast and you don't get a lot of height unless, except in certain circumstances. So you usually have to toggle between that and paragliding. But I'd seen that, I think John Walker had like 3:10 or something. Mm. And someone else, possibly Phil Savage, had like 4 minutes or something. And it's like, that's just a lot of time, just in real time, to do this. Even if you can do it, even if it was trivially easy, it's just a lot of time to invest in passing someone else's score. So I didn't like stop and try and beat those scores. But in the back of my mind, it was always, at some point, I love wingsuiting. I do it a lot, and I'm pretty sure I can do it indefinitely.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any actual like hard limit on how long I can do this. So next time I'm having a good run, I might just extend it a little bit further just to make sure I'm ahead of John Walker and Phil Savage. And I think I did eventually.
Mm.
These systems get me in every single context and probably could get me to do almost anything.
Devil Daggers, certainly, because I remember being on Skype with you, and I can tell when you're playing Devil Daggers because of the clicking and the kind of the absent-minded mmms when I'm talking.
I actually find it quite easy to listen when playing Devil Daggers, because the part of my brain that is playing that game is not the part of my brain that listens.
However, but like, I remember this back and forth between you and one of our friends, and it was just like every time you got a higher score than the one that was listed for him, there would be this moment where I'd be talking and then suddenly you would break in because jubilation, and then, you know, I'd hear the tapping of you sending an email of like insult and jeering and derision or whatever.
Eat it,
it was
Matt.
Yeah, exactly. Or like,
I haven't played that game in a while actually.
And so Tom, did you ever get that way with like Spelunky dailies or anything?
No, because the scoring system for those was a bit I'll avoid using a pejorative and just say it didn't reflect what I cared about in that game. It was how much money you had when you died, which is really arbitrary. You can you can die on level 4 with a load of money. And there's no particular reason you would be hoarding money except just to kind of come high in the leaderboards. But then it kind of, you know, dissuades you against buying things. I also, for a long time, still really don't like attacking the shopkeepers. And that's really, I guess, the scoreboard is for people who do that. But even then, I just think progress through the game is like the primary measure of your success. If you got through hell, you beat anyone who didn't get through hell. And if you completed the game, you beat anyone who didn't complete the game. And if you got close to completing the game, but you didn't quite complete it, you should beat everyone else.
Yeah, I feel like money should be like a tiebreaker. If you're both at 2-1, then...
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I remember I felt like maybe the daily challenge was more for people who had got good at the game sort of away from that. Because I would go in, I'd have got to the second world, and that was like a huge thing for me, and it was like the most exciting thing, and I saw a frog and all you know, all of that kind of stuff. And then so I would submit that, and it would be and then I would see that, you know, everybody else had got to like the end, and I was like, oh, for God's sake. And you know, you'd get Graham kind of like with his shopkeeper attack fetish logging into, what was it, he actually went on the official like PC Gamer account.
Yeah,
he
tried to rob a shopkeeper, got immediately killed by him on like level 2, and then he's like, oh, this is so bad that I've got access to another account, I'm gonna log in as that and then do it again. And then he for some reason was tempted to try the exact same thing.
It was,
and got killed by the exact
same
way.
He talked himself into it by trying to talk himself out of it, because you would listen to it and he would say, he was going, I'm not going to attack him this time because he killed me last time. I'm definitely not going to attack him. I'm going to kill him. It was kind of like this. It went on for a bit longer than that. But
I guess, that's... But in general, with the daily challenge, it's not... knowing your friend's scores doesn't incentivize you to do anything, because you can't. Like, you don't know their scores until you finish.
Yeah,
and then once you finish, you can't play it again.
I think it was more that it kind of... It pushed a bit of the wind out of my sails that I felt like I'd achieved.
It was only a negative, yeah.
So I was kind of like, oh, I saw a thing that I'd never seen before. Oh, everyone else has seen like a million things that I've never seen before.
The only thing that's quite nice about it these days is because not that many people play it anymore. Every now and then I will do a daily challenge, and every now and then I'll just see like, oh, Chris Dolan did today's as well. And so I can talk to him about it.
That's awesome. I used to get a bit more competitive when it was, you know, you could get like the ghosts of other people's like carts in like, you know, Mario Kart or whatever.
Right.
So I would get competitive over that kind of thing. But then on the DS, I think you could still do it on the DS, but then everybody else in the universe mastered snaking and I couldn't do it. And then it was like, oh, well, fine.
What is snaking?
It's a particular way of skidding your car hither and yon, which gives you all kinds of speed.
Like the kids do.
As the Mario does, skidding his car hither and yon.
Go with the Mario. Hither and yon. And the rainbow sparks did flow as he picked
toward
up
yonder
speed,
finish line.
By alternately jumping and breaking in little snaky
with
lines.
Shells of azure.
Oh, anyway.
Cast forth the red shell, quoth the toad. Be done with this prick.
So,
what
for many
happened,
reasons,
said
I'm
Luigi.
Done with Mario Sorry. Kart.
I want to do Chaucerian Mario Kart now.
Shall we Carterbury. Move on to a new question?
Carterbury Tales.
Oh. I would high five you, but you're too far away. Anyway, Chris Kinneberg says, when the Enchanted Mango was released for Dota 2, I tried my first mango. What things have you tried because of games?
I took an archery class because every game I was playing that had bows in it was really fucking cool. And I was always thinking, oh, bows are really good. I should try a bow. And I did. And it was really good. I haven't been back, but that's mostly because it's far away and I'm lazy. But I don't have a garden in which I could do archery. I have a garden, but it's short enough that I would kill someone who's not in the garden if I tried archery. But my parents' garden is big enough.
Could you make like a little bow out of maybe a rubber band and a toothpick and things?
That might defeat the pleasure of actually. Yeah.
Okay.
Because the thing that is cool about it is it's like every part of it is really satisfying. Like drawing a bow is really satisfying. Loosing an arrow is really satisfying. And then the thud when it hits is really satisfying. Yeah. Pulling it out of the target is really satisfying.
Just satisfying all the way down.
Yep.
Wow. That's probably
games are right. Things you see in games, you should go out and do in real life, I would say.
All of them. That's why I learned to fence.
Is it?
I was into Jedi Knight online sword fighting.
I was going to say, were you really into Nidhogg?
No, it wasn't out there.
That was quite recent.
It was that and The Princess Bride were the two reasons I wanted to know how to sword fight. I just wanted that to happen to me in real life at some point, because I am actually left-handed.
Oh, okay.
I don't think of... I don't know, games have made me do loads of things. Got a job because of games. I was, you know, wouldn't stop fucking talking about them, so eventually I was like, someone should pay me for this.
I saw someone in a game who had a job, so when I got a job.
Yeah. I think I can't think of anything I saw in a game and then did it because it was cool in the game or because I was excited about that. But I did try a mango because of Poirot. Because there's an episode where he actually shows people how you cut it and how you score it and turn it inside out to like eat it.
Yeah, the mango hedgehog technique.
Yeah. And so, because I'd had mangoes before, but I'd always sort of ended up in this weird sticky mess of like attacking the, you know how the core kind of gets a bit stuck sometimes? And so I'd sort of be mashing at it with a spoon and like, you know, a knife and all.
It's really big and really flat, which makes it kind of hard to like cut around it.
And it's also lots of fiber as well. Like it's really fibrous. And so I would just sort of like be hacking away at this thing and then David Suchet's Poirot showed me how to mango, and it's also good for avocados.
Do you know that most of the mangoes we get here are garbage? Because some American grower called Tom someone, I can't remember his surname.
Was it you?
As far as I recall, it wasn't me. figured out a breed that wouldn't bruise easily and was very large and very colourful.
So the opposite of the Tasha Bedingfield.
Okay. But
she bruises easily.
Really?
Yeah, she had a whole song about it. What? I bruise easily. So be careful when you handle me or something.
When you grow me in your mango farms.
Yeah, when you mango me.
So she was in fact singing about a less marketable form of mango.
But a tastier one, presumably.
So the problem with the Tom whatever mango is that...
As opposed to the Beddingfield mango.
It's very fibrous and not that tasty. And like the kinds of mangoes that they eat in like India and most of the countries where a mango is just a fruit that you would buy as a snack, are much smaller. They're usually just kind of plain yellow, and the flesh is like incredibly creamy and smooth and deliciously sweet and like a totally different flavor.
The mangoes they have.
Yeah, so also, don't
they
get the Tommy
50 mana immediately.
Tommy.
And give you a flat 7.5 HP a second regen when you haven't consumed it.
But the ones that we get over in this country then are good for salsa. If you cook it down with some, I do it with cherry tomatoes and some onion, like cook it down. It's actually really nice.
Does
like
the fibrous
it's not all the mangoes we get here are that variety. You can see what the variety is. Usually they'll tell you. And
I'm going to have to research.
So the moral of the story is just don't be put off if they're small and yellow, because that doesn't mean they're bad.
Yeah, well, Chris here doesn't say whether the mango was good or tasty. So maybe if you didn't like that mango, persevere, look up different mangoes, talk to this Tom person. Or
is the mango in Dota red and green?
Who knows? What
colour is the mango in Dota?
Oh, it's mango colour.
It's yellow.
It fades to...
Do you see the skin?
No, there's a kind of like a blush. It sort of, it goes...
There's a gentle mango blush.
I've looked at that icon far too much because I photoshopped it onto the picture of that amazing car that I found in
Grand Theft Auto
GTA 5 that you and Dan firebombed until it blew up without realising I didn't have insurance, and then we had to all find the next car.
I felt so bad about it. I spent an hour and a half driving around Los Santos trying to find another one of those cars in the right colour.
It was a great car. In conclusion, oh no, that's something. I didn't exactly try something as a result of a video game, but I got so weirdly obsessed with a Subaru Impreza in Gran Turismo that somebody was actually driving one through Reading, and I nearly sort of followed them. I was in my car, which was a really shitty Citroën AX. And really didn't work reliably.
Why are you going to steal it?
I was just really into it. So I was just following them and realised I wasn't going to work instead. You know, I was kind of like, oh no, I've actually got a place to be. There was a reason that I was in my car. I just sort of followed a Subaru for a while. It was great. And also probably a bit weird for them. And Reading's got a really annoying one-way system, so I had to go really long way round to work. I'm going to stop talking now, except for reading out the other person's questions. So, Destro7000 says, "Hi, Cajun Ahoba. Have you played Space Engineers, brackets, now with planets, close brackets? And if so, what did you build? ?
No.
But Pip... For whom the answer is yes.
Well, I've played Space Engineers, but not now with planets. I played it a while ago because Craig Pearson needed help with writing about it for RPS, I think, before I was working there. And we tried out some of the custom ships. And so, like, it was stuff like I didn't build anything, I don't think. I played it for you guys, for PC Gamer. Mm. And I built a brutalist palazzo in space and then crashed into it by accident, I think.
Yes, you did.
But there's a big dent in the
brutalist palazzo.
Yeah, like I think I might have built a pediment and then crashed into it, if memory serves.
What's a pediment?
It's like the triangular bit at the top of a temple. Anyway, but that was one thing. But you can also download other people's builds, other people's like constructions, and have them in your space and play around with them. So I think one of the things he downloaded was Homer Simpson, and you could like climb inside his mouth and like go into his like guts, and they had actually like an approximation of guts that I got lost in, and I think I tunneled out of his back because I was like lost. But also there was this really cool thing that was like an articulated shark. And so you could like, if you drove it in the right way, you could actually get it to like sway through space.
Oh, you could fly the shark?
Yeah, like it was actually swimming and stuff. But, so Craig was like a bit further out, like, cause you can jetpack around and stuff. And he was taking pictures of this for like screenshots and things. And then, but I waggled the shark too hard and it snapped in half. And then I couldn't pretend that I wasn't in charge of the shark because I was still in the pilot seat. And he was just like, you've actually like, and he started using the phrase pipped this up. And I was like, oh, well. And there was another one where I think I left the, I think it was that you leave the engines running or something. Oh no, it was because you kind of have like no friction. So if you send something off into space by accident, it just keeps going. And that's how we lost the massive Han Solo in carbonite because I pushed that off into space and it just never
dark
stopped.
Twist.
And that's also how I lost the space bee because one of the things that I made myself was a bee. Out of just these building blocks and stuff. But then I think I rocketed away from it in some weird direction and I couldn't work out how to slow myself down. And then the space bee
space
was lost
bee, no.
forever. So in conclusion, I have played Space Engineers, but I don't think I played Space Engineers in the way that it was supposed to be played. The next one is from Henry Stenhouse, who asks, which video game character eats the most food? Denton? Booker from Bioshock is certainly the least healthy with those bins. That's true.
What about Pac-Man? If the dots are food, he eats a lot of them.
Yeah, maybe they're food pills. It's a futuristic kind of... But then
like weight loss
would he
pills.
Have, but why would he have cherries?
Maybe, like, they're all weight loss pills, and he needs that many to counteract the amount he's going to put on from eating a cherry that's nearly the size of his body.
Let alone eating a ghost. Holy shit.
That's true. Maybe the ghosts get rid of the cherries, because, like, maybe it counters a dead thing with an undead thing.
Mm.
I mean, not a dead thing. The cherries wouldn't... Hang on. I'm confused. Yes.
BJ Baskovitz, probably the first of the first-person shooter protagonists to... heal gunshot wounds by eating whole Sunday roasts.
But that's like, that's not out of the ordinary, right? Like,
I mean,
not eating
work,
the most food.
Saying. No.
Like, that, unless he was
the health pickups were like an entire chicken dinner, right?
Just
on the floor in this Nazi prison.
Yeah, and you would run over them, a couple
Who
of them.
Makes
How
these?
Much health did they restore?
Who makes these, the chicken dinners?
Yeah. Where do they come from?
That is an excellent question.
Is there like... a malfunctioning like catering bot or something.
Well, it's the 40s, so one would assume not. I suppose Hitler is a mech.
Yeah,
well,
Hitler's
yeah,
a mech.
Like they have the technology, right, for this?
I couldn't tell you really. Well,
what I want to know:
Nazi occult tech extends to chicken dinner bot 5000.
Does he eat anything else? Like, can he eat like I don't know profiteroles to like to heal? I don't know, like burns or something.
Profiteroles for burns, chicken dinners for health.
That's chicken dinners for gunshot wounds.
Yeah, like I thought you meant it was like specific to like bullet wounds.
No, it's just that's the kind of injury he's most likely to incur in his job as a Nazi hunting man in a big blue castle.
Yeah, like maybe you could have like a tangerine to heal a blister or something.
Or a
scurvy.
Or a Snickers to heal a dog bite.
Yeah. Works in real life as well.
Does it?
Well, no, I mean, I was thinking about scurvy. You know, you eat oranges to help with the...
That
the
prevents
whole...
you from getting scurvy, it doesn't...
But, like, once you've got scurvy, presumably, like, oranges don't hurt.
No, that's true.
Chickens are common birds encountered by BJ in Wolfenstein RPG. They are divided into chickens and enraged chickens.
Can you get an enraged chicken dinner?
Thanks, Wolfenstein Wikipedia.
I feel like this is not... What I wanted to know was how many health points does a chicken dinner restore? Because then we can figure out how many you eat to restore a full wedge of health.
Yeah.
But, I mean, but didn't it not have a numerical health bar, but a bloody picture of BJ Baskovitz's face?
Maybe it certainly had the picture
face
as well.
Maybe.
I think I had a percentage too.
But the thing is, like, when I have a roast chicken dinner, I get sleepy.
That's true, yes.
Like, so if he's like running away, like he'll be healthy, but he'll be in need of a nap.
10 health points for a chicken.
You have to eat 10 chicken dinners. Well, yeah.
To cure yourself from dead.
From nearly, like if you're on one health point, you need 10
Can
chicken
imagine,
dinners to get back
like,
up to
100. Could you stock up in advance? Like, so if you were facing death by firing squad, could you have 10 chicken dinners?
No, your health doesn't go over 100.
Gradually, like, but you'd be digesting them. So maybe as long as they only shot you like every sort of 30 minutes.
I think it doubles as your hunger meter, because I don't think you can eat them when you're at 100. Like, if you're at 100 and you walk over one, it doesn't go into your mouth.
So you have
That's
to
how
be
I
hungry.
Detect whether I'm hungry.
You just roll over the food.
Just tread on it if it doesn't appear
in
your mouth.
Didn't go in my mouth. I'm not hungry.
You're one of those people at the Pizza Hut buffet. Rolling
get a
around
run up, do a forward roll into it.
Like
you'll only absorb food
on the buffet.
I don't know if we've answered the question, but we've certainly said something.
It's like osmosis. It's only if the food density inside your body is lower than the food density outside your body that you actually absorb anything.
Chicken dinners. BJ Blazkowicz as chicken sponge.
So, Midnight Shower Boy asks, will VR allow me to play real games from the comfort of my bed, brackets, i.e. not phone games, close brackets, question mark, I need this.
Yes, because there's like virtual desktop stuff. Like, I think even Vive comes with this by default, where you can play whatever you want projected in front of you as a sort of virtual thing.
You can certainly play your Steam library through that.
Yeah, so yeah. Presumably if you wanted to and you could deal with having the cable sticking out the back of your head, you could lie in bed and...
Yeah, it's got to be... So like I've seen a demo of this and one of your freehand 3D controllers sort of casts a ray out to the screen in the virtual world, and where it hits that, that's where your cursor is. Yeah. So that's how they simulate mouse movement. I don't know that they have a sort of universal system for simulating all of the keyboard. Like if you're
I assume it would have to be a gamepad thing.
Yeah, it must simulate
the
gamepad.
I did it with when I tried it, I was playing Broforce, so that was gamepad.
Through virtual desktop.
Yeah. Yeah, I tried that at GDC.
And did the... Because the controllers are like sort of touchpads on the thumbs, aren't they?
I think if I remember rightly, it might have been a 360 controller.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't
was
a Steam controller. But
yeah, I mean, that's sort of... So I suppose really the challenge is not control so much, because you already have 360 controllers for like a lot of games. And so it's just like, can he lie in his bed and see the games?
Well, I think...
But that's what I'm saying, the VR headset.
Yeah.
Good.
So I think the bigger thing for me would be that when I'm lying down and I'm playing something on my phone or something that requires, you know, like, because I could technically lie in bed and play Destiny or something, but it's more that the fact that my back is comfy and I'm lying down means then that my arms have to do something a bit suboptimal, so
yeah.
I actually end up with like slight pain in my elbows or whatever, simply because of when it's my phone, it's more noticeable because you have to hold it closer to your face, so your arms are at that weird angle. But even if
because
you had
like
your gamepad, it was, you know, you'd have to rest it on maybe your lap, or I think that would probably be a bit of a limiting factor.
Many a person has dropped their phone or tablet onto their face whilst trying to use it in bed due to arm fatigue.
Shall we do a couple more?
Yep,
sure.
So Particle Garvin says, why do people enjoy criticism of bad games so much?
Sometimes they get very angry about it, but I think in the cases where they're not very angry about it, it's Schadenfreude. Perhaps not particularly fair, but people like, I don't know, they like joining in on the feeling that you can all gather around and kick something to death. That's one of the basic human instincts.
Mm.
Like,
there's
a
strong sense of like justice amongst gamers as well. They sort of like feel, you know, they strongly want to see the devs they like rewarded, and they strongly want to see the other devs in some way punished, or
they want
to see the games they don't like fail, and they want to see the games they do like succeed. And like I have that to some extent, you know, if everyone's absolutely raving about a game I really hate, there's a part of me that thinks, kind of don't want it to actually take over the world. And, you know, equally the things that I do love, I, you know, it's really heartbreaking when something you love doesn't get the attention you want it to.
Hmm.
And so there's, I don't really personally enjoy seeing a bad game ripped to shreds. Like even the really bad ones, like, you know, what's the Limbo of the Lost? Is that a...
That's a thing. I don't know what it is.
It's the game with, like, there was a big scandal about it having stolen assets, and also it's just kind of terrible, and sort of famously bad. And then it ends with this bizarre musical number. Richard Cobbett has definitely done probably a lot on this game, but I think at the very least a crapshoot video. But like stuff like that, I always think the worst stuff probably comes from a terrible work environment where, you know, it's been mismanaged to hell and there's probably no team where, like, there isn't some good people on it. Mm-hmm. And some people are really trying to do their best and they get screwed by people who outrank them, and or just by constraints and just by the budget and just by the fact that, like, maybe there's people on the team who are totally screwing it up and they can't get rid of those people, and so all the good work gets wasted.
Mm. I think sometimes there's also an element of, like, sometimes when I've read people talking about bad games, and not necessarily in the press, but, you know, sort of Twitter or blogs or, you know, whatever people are sort of gathering round to communicate, there's a sort of, if something goes bad beyond a certain threshold, sort of not needing to hold back in some way. So sometimes the writing itself can be a bit freer.
Yeah.
Which I think can actually be attractive in terms of reading it, because yeah, people stop trying to caveat stuff and just yeah, properly go full into
yeah, the hardest review to write
rant.
The hardest review to write is like 60% or something, because it's like you can't, you're not going to enjoy giving it a kicking. You also can't really recommend it. So you just have to be constantly just saying, like, ah, you know, it's kind of trying to do this, but it doesn't really work.
And work out why it doesn't work.
It's just not that much fun to read something that's like, you know, a painful, mediocre thing.
Yeah. Well, in that case, because somebody else piggybacked on the question, I believe their name seems to be Yay. So that's nice.
Woo.
But it's, if I may piggyback a related question, do any of you get any pleasure from giving a deserving game a kicking?
No.
I would say I don't either. I don't, because even when it has gone wrong, you're sort of always looking at reasons why, or trying to sort of to not go into that hyperbolic rant kind of style, because it feels like it, you always never quite know the whole story as well.
Yeah.
And like sometimes you'll find this with, you know, a few years later, the full details come out, or, you know, someone starts talking about what actually happened, or they'll do a retrospective or something, or like a what's it called? A post-mortem. And then you find out that things weren't quite as they seemed, or that, you know, there was just a whole bunch of stuff. And so, I don't really feel like I have the, you know, I'll say what was bad about it and I'll say why it was bad or why I didn't like it, but I, like, I think knowing that side of things, or at least knowing that I don't know, kind of kills that sense of reveling in it almost. I just don't
it's still somebody's work at the end of the day, and no one's setting out to make something bad on purpose. Like, styling on it just because it's bad is a bit of a dick move, really, in my opinion.
And as a final question, I believe we have Neil, who is saying, what is the first game that you wanted to 100% and why?
I have never 100%ed a game.
I was going to say, you're still waiting for your 100%er.
I don't think I've ever wanted to, really. Because there's always some collectible bullshit. Like, almost any game that measures your percentage, it's because they have a million different things to do, and one of them would always be collect the, all the little packages, all the little tokens, all the little feathers, and I never want to do that. And so I never really care.
Has there ever been a thing that, even if it isn't the whole game being 100% done, that you have obsessively tried to do?
Yeah, maybe not obsessively, but every Far Cry game, I want to do all the outposts, because that's the thing I really enjoy. And it's, I think I'm on the very last outpost in Far Cry Primal now. Far Cry Primal also has bonfires, which are like smaller outposts, and I have more of those to go. but I'm definitely going to keep playing that until I've done all of them. I actually didn't in Far Cry 4 because it just got super hard. Like, the last couple were just brutal. And I started getting frustrated with it. But those are the ones that where, like, I care about completing it.
Mm. Well, I think I've said this on the podcast before, but for a long time I saw 100%ing a game or, like, getting 1,000 gamer score as a way of, like, giving a nod to the developer that I like the game. So probably the most notable first one would be Mass Effect. And that was such a pain in the ass to do. But also Assassin's Creed 2 and Brotherhood. The Tomb Raider games before they were about a cold woman being sad.
Yeah. I think the first, it's, again, it's not going to be a PC game, but it was Ocarina of Time on the N64. And that was just, it was a huge world for me at the time, and I think for everyone at the time, but it was, it also felt manageably huge. Like, there were, so you could collect all of the different heart pieces, but you would find those out by pretty much just exploring the entire world and blowing up interesting looking rocks and stuff as you were going about your business and sort of trading that information with friends. And, you know, it was sort of, it was that level of, engagement, I guess. And then there were also these gold spiders called sculptulas, and they were a particular kind of that spider, the gold ones, and they would be in particular locations, and you'd hear this sort of weird crunchy crawling noise nearby, and then you'd get totally distracted from what you were going to do at the time, and then you'd just seek these things out, and it was to, like, help break a curse of, like, a particular family and stuff like that. And so that stuff was just, I really loved it because for me it was part of revisiting that world and then sort of polishing off the challenges and also getting to see all of the little touches and the little underground caverns and all of that kind of stuff that I absolutely loved. And then I get it sometimes with, like, racing games or something, like getting gold on all of the courses or whatever else, but I tend not to with other kinds of games like Assassin's Creed or with, you know, with any of those, because they just feel too big and it feels so pointless. Like,
yeah.
I don't feel any attachment to those things. I did with the spiders and the heart pieces because they were so sort of baked into my experience of that game and what I was doing and what I was getting out of it and how happy I was to be there and to see more of it. But all of that stuff, it's just mindless busy work that's just like, oh, well, we want you to stay in our world for longer rather than going and seeing someone else's world. And it just feels like, what's the equivalent of a land grab but for people's life?
Life grab.
Yeah.
Time grab, yeah.
Yeah. That feels like a downer.
It works for some people, though.
As someone who 100%ed two different Assassin's Creed games, I just did it because I wanted to spend more time in that world. So it is subjective, I think.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, for me, that just, because I never liked Assassin's Creed either. Like, I've never found my way into that game world where I actually enjoy being in there, because something always happens. Like, it's always, oh, it's totally open and you can totally run up the sides of building, except, oh, maybe not that building, and that window's going to get in the way, and what are you doing over here, and you have to turn back otherwise you'll break the genetic nonsense leash thing that we've set up for some arbitrary reason. So
my friend Zach Johnson has a friend of his who I don't know, who is one of those completionist people who just, like, when you give them a game that has X things to do, they'll do all of the X things. And so he said to me one day, you should play desert golfing. And
he's still there.
Yeah, he did, like, I think he broke some kind of record. Like, he got to some level no one had got to before. Like, it's,
oh, wow.
A, you know, desert golfing, for anyone who doesn't know, is a game that seems to certainly at least procedurally generate a lot of its levels. It's unclear whether any of them are hand built. Some of them seem to be the same for all players. Some of them seem to be different for different players. But it certainly goes on indefinitely. And there was a sort of legend going around at the time that if you hit hole 99999, you turned around and went back.
Yeah.
And that is not true. It just keeps going. And I think this guy found that out the hard way.
And that is all the questions we've got time for. If you'd like to send us a question for a future episode, you can email us at questions@creightoncrowbar.com. You could leave a question on the forum at creightoncrowbar.com/forum. Or you can tweet us on Twitter at creightoncrowbar. You can also discuss the episode on the forum or on Discord, which is where the community tends to hang out nowadays. And there's a link to Discord probably in the show notes and definitely in the sidebar of the website. And if you would like to tweet us individually, Pip is...
I am at Philippa War, which is PHILIPPAWARR.
Counting on her fingers there.
It helps, shut up.
Tom is...
At Pentadact, PENTADACT.
And I'm at C Thurston, that's CTHURSTEN. Thanks for pipping, everybody.
I need to work on that.